So before we take any questions anyone has, we're talking about Zen. We started talking about Zen last week, which in and of itself is probably, to talk about Zen sounds very un-Zen-ish. But again, a master once said, when was asked, what is the highest teaching of Zen? What is the deepest teaching of Zen? The master said, maybe many of you heard this before, but I'm reminded of it tonight. In winter, I freeze. In summer, I sweat. So we're doing a little bit of that tonight. But that really points to the utter naturalness of the Zen teaching. Right? My awakening, my awareness, my mindfulness is not outside of the way things are. Right? How are things when it's winter? Cold. How are things in the heat of the summer? Hot. When I'm freezing, how is it? Right? When it's the midst of summer, I'm sweating. Just like that. There's a lot of truth in that capacity to understand that our practice is about realizing the inherent perfection of this moment, rather than having some sense of some ideal moment that we think we should be in. Right? I mean, we could be miserable tonight, some people, right? It's so hot, it's so uncomfortable, so many people, right? Do you know what I mean? We could just... that's called increasing our suffering. The truth is what? We're here. And it's hot. Right? What?
Or dry.
Or?
Dry.
Or dry?
Not wet.
Not wet. And we are dry. Somebody who sees the cup is half full. Good. If you asked a Zen practitioner, what are you doing? And if they said, I'm listening to the rain, right? You might say what to them? You think they're a good practitioner? I am listening to the rain. Dave says, yes. You know what I say? So-so. Because the practice of Zen is more than just mindfulness. To say, I am sitting here listening to the rain, is good, is it? Somebody is practicing mindfulness. They know where they are, and they know what's going on. Right? And... as we know, sitting here enjoying the rain, the sound of the rain, can give us happiness and can be very soothing. Right? It can be really a meditative experience. But when you say, I am here listening to the rain, you are only practicing within the realm of mindfulness. Right? And Buddhist meditation involves mindfulness, concentration, and insight. So, Zen master says, what are you doing? And you say, I'm listening to the rain, and I'm really enjoying it. So you know what happens? The Zen master may give you 40 blows, throw you out of his room. Then you might say, why, right? Why? I'm present. I know where I am, right? I'm enjoying the natural sound of the rain, right? Isn't that Zen? Because in that answer, the person is presenting that their experience is that there is an I that is experiencing something called a sound, rain, right? That is called duality, separation. And the Zen experience is to get us beyond that. When there's no I, when there's no rain, and there's no listening, what's left? Actually, I would say to you, if we just listen, just let's spend a moment just listening. And again, I'm just using a word saying just listening, right? But I'm really just pointing you toward experiencing something. Now, if you go into that experience of just this, when you're not thinking anything, and there's only the sound, in a certain way you allow yourself to relax into or disappear, so there's only the sound, even for a moment. Please just listen totally to the sound, just direct experience. And then say the words, "It's raining." And I'd say to you, what do the words, "It's raining," have to do with this experience? And if you were given a choice, would you rather have the words, "It's raining," or would you rather have just the experience of this that you're hearing now? Which would you choose? Which is rich? Which is alive? And which is just merely a label, a word. And as you just listen, in that listening, is there really a self, an I, an ego that is listening? Is there really some permanent entity or thing called rain? So in Zen, as we talked about last week, we understand that words are just fingers pointing at the moon. Right? So I don't know where the moon is these days. It's been kind of cloudy, but maybe we're close to a full moon. So if we, what? It's past? Well, let's just pretend it's a full moon. And we went outside and the night was clear. And somebody said, look at the moon. Right? Would you look at the finger? Holding up a finger, look at the moon. Would you look at the finger? No. What would you do? Yeah. You'd look, you'd follow the finger to the experience, right? If you stopped at the finger, you would never see the moon. Right? You'd never have that experience. That magical experience of seeing the moon, right? If we just looked at the finger. In the same way, words in Zen are simply pointers in the direction of an experience, right? So if somebody says, listen to the rain, you don't just go, oh, listen to the rain, listen to the rain, listen to the rain. Oh, it's raining. That's not an experience, is it? You'd want to stop, right? And listen, right? Put your hand out, feel it. Right? Oh, that's what the word raining is about. It's an experience. Right? So if I call this thing over here Dave, right? And I say, oh, there's Dave. Right? What have I said? Nothing. I've just labeled. Right? If I want to experience Dave, I have to just look. I have to see. I have to hear. I have to feel. Right? I have to listen to. Right? So even the Zen of relationships is the capacity of getting beyond words and entering into an authentic experience with another human being. And whether that authentic experience is with rain or with another human being or with a cup of tea, right? Or with walking or breathing or feeling an emotion. Does anybody remember the verse that we shared from Wang Po last week? You remember it? How does it go? Yeah. But do you remember the actual verse? I mean, I have it in front of me. This is, I can act like a big shot. You got it down? Very good, Nadia. So that's Wang Po. The foolish reject what they see, not what they think. The wise reject what they think, not what they see. Right? When we talk about seeing, we talk about, again, direct experience, right? The foolish person, because they're lost in their thoughts, lost in their story, lost in their projections, lost in their issues, does not experience reality. It only experiences their perceptions, their thoughts, their projections, etc., about reality. Right? And we know that many people who are totally lost in their own stuff, that even when reality begins to unfold in a different way other than their story, what do? They reject reality and cling to their thoughts, cling to their story, cling to their issues, cling to their projections. That's how foolish we can be. But the wise understand what is reality and understand that their thoughts about reality are made up. And who makes them up? Each of us makes them up. Right? So even though there may be 30, 35 people here tonight, right? We would think, oh, we're all here, right? All of us, right? We're all in the same room. We're all sitting kind of on the same cushions. You're all listening to me. I'm all looking at you. You know, we would think, oh, we're all having the same experience, aren't we? And yet, we know that if we went around the room and we asked people, oh, what are you experiencing, or what went on tonight, right? By the end, we might wonder, were we all in the same room together? Or did we all hear the same talk? Right? Because so immediately, we go into our abstract thinking, our analyzing, our judging, our comparing, our evaluating, our projecting. And again, it's not as if that's bad, right? So please, if all of you are feeling bad now, do you know what I mean? It's not about feeling bad that these things arise. They arise because that's the way our mind has been used. The problem is that we believe they're true, that they're giving us a true picture of reality. Which robs us of our capacity to be truly alive. Alive to whatever is truly arising in the moment. Mindfulness, again, allows us to know that there's a present moment going on. But the deeper looking allows us to disappear into that moment and fully grasped the meaning. Does this sound, is this confusing? No. Zen practice requires non-attachment to thought. This is where we ended last week. It's very important. It's not that Zen practice rejects thought. Zen practice suppresses thought. Right? Thinking is just another experience, right? Thoughts arise and pass away to our minds, right? Sights, objects are constantly arising, passing to our eyes. Sounds to our ears, taste to our mouth. Our body is constantly feeling different sensations, right? So what that means is, you know, again, I don't keep my, if I'm looking around, I'm just looking around, right? And just wherever the eyes go, we allow it to go and we take in what we take in. But, you know, we don't fixate, right? K, Can you see? If I fixate, I stop, right? I artificially stop. And I constrict. And that's, again, what we do often with our thoughts, because we seem to be, many of us, quite capable of going back about our life and quite willing as we go through our days to let sights unfold to our eyes, right? And let them keep changing. We don't have to grasp onto what we saw 5 minutes ago. We can be quite present to what we're seeing now. We can be quite present to what we're listening to now. We can be quite present, etc., to all our senses. But for some reason, in the realm of thought, we fixate. And we stop and we repeat the same stuff over and over and over again. Same stories we project over and over and over again, right? So we do something very different, unfortunately, in the realm of thought. So the Zen practice is about just not being attached to the thought the same way you aren't attached to what you see and what you hear. You just let it unfold. Which means what? We let thoughts come and go. They rise and they disappear. They rise and they disappear. They rise and they disappear. Right? Anybody notice that? From morning till night. They just rise and disappear. Right? Sights come and go. Sounds come and go. Right? Different sounds now. We're okay with that, right? But this process of learning to be non-attached to thought, to our thoughts, takes some training, doesn't it? That's where the meditation comes in. That's where the practice comes in. That's why we have to learn to sit, and to sit in awareness and mindfulness, and learn to allow thoughts to come and go without grasping at them. To let our minds be freer. But especially we're doing that so as we go about our daily life, we can be that way. We can have a very free mind where we can just go through the day, going from one experience to the next experience, to the next experience, to the next experience, right? Be totally present, totally absorbed, totally involved, not holding on to things that have happened earlier in the day or earlier in my lifetime. Who knows? Huh? Getting exciting, isn't it? So again, oftentimes when we read about Zen or approach Zen, it seems very difficult or far away or somewhat esoteric when we read these interchanges and anecdotes of the masters. But please understand, it's totally practical. Right? It's teaching us how to be free. And to teach us how to be free means it's teaching us how to be happy. Teaching us how to be calm in the midst of activity. Right? Most of us live lives in which there is lots of activity. There's a lot, right, that we're involved in, a lot that's unfolding. Right? Some of us have things unfolding all the time. Some of us are maybe quiet or calmer lives, but then anyhow, things are constantly unfolding in our life. And so Zen, the practice of Zen helps us be with the unfolding, right, in a relaxed, open, spacious, and non-attached way. And I think I've left out one very important ingredient here, which is the self, right? Because if there's any mischief maker within us, it is that self, remember? The self. That really there was no self listening. There was just listening. But yet we do have this mistaken, yet deeply held belief, right? That there is some kind of permanent self that exists inside us, right? That kind of owns this whole thing, right? It's sort of like, yes, there's hearing, yes, there's seeing, yes, there's thinking, yes, there's feeling, yes, there's loving, yes, there's hating, yes, there's all this stuff, right? But there's somebody inside who owns it, right? Who runs the show, who's in control, right? I mean, that's the way we talk, don't we? And because we think that is true, it's that self, that ego, that I, that me, that's mine, that's always attaching, right, to this unfolding world of just phenomena arising and passing away. So the practice of Zen has a lot to do with looking into this self, right? Because let's say, remember that person who says to the Zen teacher, what are you doing? Oh, I am listening. They say quite proudly, feeling quite Zen-ish. I'm just listening to the rain. Quite proud of themselves, they say. And the Zen teacher would say, what is this I that thinks it's listening to the rain? Can you show it to me? See, in Zen, Zen masters are very practical and very down to earth. And they would say, well, if something exists, you'd be able to show it, right? So, what is your name? What?
Anthony.
So if I said, Anthony, can you show me your right hand? Anthony could go what? Yeah, I mean, he could hold up his right hand. If I said, Anthony, could you show me your left foot? Anthony could go, yeah, okay. Right? So we'd say, oh, okay. So if I was kind of giving Anthony a hard time saying, no, you really don't have a hand, Anthony could kind of, right? Show me his hand. So in the same way, Anthony might say, well, you know, I have a self, right? My name is Anthony, and this is my body, right? Anthony might say, yes, that's Anthony's left foot, right? And that's Anthony's right hand, right? We do talk this way, don't we? Kind of a shared delusion we're all participating in. So I'd say, okay. If I asked Anthony, okay, can you show me this Anthony that owns that foot and hand? Anthony would go what? What? You can't show it to me. Why not? It's okay, he's very good. Anthony says, well, because it's something you feel inside. Right? So there's an Anthony inside, right? It's like a feeling that somehow that left foot and right hand, or is it the left hand and the right foot, belong to something called Anthony that's a feeling inside, right? Okay. And then the Zen master would say, okay, well, if that's true, right, and we certainly believe you, Anthony, you might say, well, can you show me that feeling inside that's called Anthony? Well, could you at least find it yourself so you could see where it is? And have you found it? It comes and goes. So it's not real, permanently real. comes and goes. Yeah, it kind of gets confusing, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's... Yeah. So then the Zen master might say, well, it comes and goes. So can you tell me where does it come from? And where does it go when it goes? And Anthony goes, this is really getting strange. But this is the kind of stuff this is what really Zen is about. Right? That we start looking into these, because if all of us agree that it's that strong sense of self, strong ego, strong sense of I and my stands in opposition to the world, and you know, I like this and I don't like that, and I want you to be like this and I want to be treated like that, and I, you know what I mean? That, you know that one?
Yeah.
If that's like the one that's always stirring up trouble inside us, right? We certainly would want to know what it really is, wouldn't we? Right? I mean, if in Anthony's house, there was always like things happening, you know what I mean? He'd do the dishes, and then they'd come down the next morning, and the sink would be full of dirty dishes again, or, you know, hang up his clothes, and that goes to his closet the next day, they're all on the floor, right? I mean, if there was something kind of stirring up trouble like that, you'd after a day or two go, I need to look into this, right? Yeah, I mean, I gotta, you know, stay up late at night or do something. You know, I gotta find out who's causing all this trouble, right? I mean, you probably just wouldn't adjust to it, would you? Especially if it was bothersome, right? Troublemaking. So in the same way, this issue of self, of I, needs to be looked into, especially if you see that it's the prime mover that's always getting us into trouble. That if we look at our emotional life, our ups and downs, our happinesses, our sadnesses, our fears, our angers, our resentments, our hurts, our impatience, you know what I mean, et cetera, et cetera. If we see that so much of that is tied to this self, right? And that not all the experiences of self are happy. A lot of them cause disturbing, conflicting types of emotions, right, and experiences. And behaviors. A lot of times we notice that a lot of the behaviors that we're not happy about are also coming from a strong sense of a self that's trying to get attention, or trying to feel worthy, or trying to get love, or trying to appear in a certain way, right? I mean, if we see that that's what's going on, we'd really want to go, well, what is this self, right? Because it keeps things stirred up a lot inside. And in Zen, well, or in more generally in Buddhism, that introspection where we really stop and go, well, what's really going on inside, right? Because, you know, Anthony was pretty quick. He figured out his sense of being Anthony is not just in his left foot, right? He kind of figured out, no, it's really not in the body, right? The body doesn't walk around calling itself a name, does it? No. Something you call it my body. It might not think it's, you know what I mean? Because actually, if you probably ask the body, you know, and if we have any physicians in the house or anybody with any kind of medical knowledge of the body, we know it's what? It's a fairly well self-organized system, isn't it? Where most of the systems are interacting in incredibly complex ways, right? Without any intervention from a self, right? The body probably thinks it's doing a pretty good job just by itself. And actually, often the way we treat it gets in the way of its being healthy, right? So Anthony was wise enough to go, no, if I'm going to look for a sense of self, it's going to be somehow inside me, which sort of means our mind, right? It's not in the body. So we know this looking into the mind, looking into our experience to try to understand what is this self, when we have a strong sense of me or mine or separation, we kind of step back and go, what is this? Where is it coming from? Anthony said, it's like a feeling, right? But yet when he stops and really looks at it, he goes, and yet when I look for it, it's not there. It kind of disappears. That's interesting, right? It seems so solid a moment ago. And yet when I stop and I turn around and I look at it, I can't find it. Which is very interesting, isn't it? I was going to start reading tonight from a very interesting, his name was Xu Yun, Empty Cloud. He was probably the greatest 20th century Chan. Chan is what Zen is called in China. When Chan came to Japan, it was called Zen, but it was called Chan. And Chan, Xu Yun, lived to be 120 years old. He actually had a fascinating life that began in the early, you know, around in the 1840s. So he was born in the 1840s, and if you read his autobiography, he actually lived through the communist takeover and into the Red Guards. I mean, he was alive into the 60s. He was considered in Chan or Zen circles in China like the greatest master of these past centuries. And there are still Zen teachers alive today who studied with him. You know, they're older now. But I found something called his methods of practice of Zen. And I'll just and then we'll end. Before he said you begin Zen or Chan practice, he said there are certain things you need to do. He said the first thing is you need deep faith in the law of, here it's called cause and consequence. A lot of times it's called the law of cause and effect. In other words, known as karma. People are familiar with karma. It's sort of a popular term these days. But, you know, people say, oh, that's his karma, or that's her karma, or bad karma, good karma. My karma catching up with me, you know. But it's important to understand that karma has nothing to do with fate. Like, that's my karma. Like, somehow it's something outside ourselves that we're fated to experience. Or there's some kind of, written plan. You know, that's our karma. In Buddhism, karma simply means that the operating principle of this world, the world of phenomena, is cause and effect, which simply means every effect had to have a cause. Every effect had to have a cause, and vice versa. Every cause has an effect. Now, why would Xu Yun say, before you even, you know, begin any kind of serious meditation practice, one must have deep faith? And I don't think the word actually is faith, because actually it has a lot to do with trust. Deep trust in the law of cause and effect. Because the law, if you believe that how everything operates, including ourselves, the unfolding of our life, our minds, our emotions, our relationships, if it is not like fixed, you see? Because if you believe in cause and effects, you don't believe in things being fixed, right? Because things are constantly subject to change, because if you change the causes, you'll change the effects. Is it getting too late? Everybody with me? So this is a big subject, but just to say simply, this capacity to understand that the operating principle of everything is cause and effect. This happens because of that, this happens. What that means is I understand, let's say for me, that where I am right now, in terms of a myriad, many causes and effects, right? And I'm just using myself as an example, you're all the same. Many causes and effects that have just been happening to you from birth, right? Thousands, hundreds of thousands, right? And they're all, how are they manifesting? Anthony's just like me, right? Right now, how we are in this minute, this is because of all the effects of our past. Here we are. But we understand that if we introduce many new causes, they will produce new effects. Right? Which means what? Things are not fixed, things are not immutable, and everything is subject to change. Which means I can understand that I may have a mind right now filled with anger and resentment and hatred and aggressiveness and fear and loathing, and, you know what I mean? And I could be just participate in every horrendous action, you know, imaginable, right? I may be manifesting in this moment as really a horrendous, horrible, disgusting human being, right? Why? Because of all the causes that have produced me up to when? Up to this moment. Okay. But this is very important because Buddhism does really encompass not totally free will, right? But enough free will that if I can begin to understand cause and effect, especially how cause and effect has operated in my own life, I can do two things. As I experience past causes ripening within me in the present, right? I don't have to deal with them the way I used to. I could deal with them differently. Right? I mean, to take a big one, I mean, the alcoholic can get up today and decide what? I'm going to stop drinking. Right? Now, it doesn't mean that that whole movement and all the habit force is not pushing into this moment, right? To continue that pattern. But we know, right, people, you know, who have no spiritual life at all, for whatever reason, lots of reasons, can one day decide what? I am going to respond differently to that habit. I'm going to respond differently to those thoughts. I'm going to respond differently to those patterns, right? And I am, starting from today, I am going to what? I'm going to make new actions of body, speech, and mind, right? Which means I'm going to make new causes so my future will what? Be different. So this is why Xu Yun is saying, before you begin really your spiritual inner life, you have to have really strong trust in the law of cause and effect, right? Which really means that you really understand that you have the capacity to heal and transform yourself. Right. Once that understanding is strong in you, then the practices of mindfulness, meditation, concentration, insight, compassion, loving kindness, you know, all those practices that we practice to aid our transformation become much more effective, because we really understand that as I undertake all these new ways of thinking and behaving and responding and feeling, I am setting the ground for a very different future for myself. And we know, even going back to the Buddha's time, right? There was a mass murderer. I think his name was Angulimala, right? Remember Angulimala, who actually tried to, he took after the Buddha. It's a story. But anyhow, I mean, he was basically a killer and was going around killing many people, and he had an encounter with the Buddha, and he tried to go after him, but the Buddha, through his great insight and kind of spiritual power, was able to stop him and to get him to see the errors of ways, and the guy became a follower of the Buddha, and actually supposedly became a strong member of the Buddha monastic community and quite developed himself. Even though up to then he'd been a mass killer. And actually, interesting enough, it doesn't mean, you know, that when you make that turn, you still don't have effects from the past. Because it was said that after he joined the Buddhist community and became a monk and put on the robes, you know, they still would have to go into villages to beg. And he would often go into villages in where he was known. And he would be beaten. I mean, when they saw who it was, the villagers would beat him, and the Buddha would just say to him, you know, this is also the way you're working off your, you know, this is also, right, your karma from the past that you have to accept and work through. So it doesn't mean, you know, that like in this case we can just turn on a dime. I mean, if we've you know, been involved in all kinds of actions of body, speech, and mind, all of a sudden we get up to today and we say, right, totally different life, right? That all of a sudden it's clear sailing. It's not like that, is it? Because we still have all the causes from past effects that will continue to ripen. But with mindfulness and awareness, we now have the capacity to deal with them. As well as if we've embraced the spiritual path, we now know how to create causes in our life that will create very different effects for ourselves, our families, our relationships, our community, for the future. So we will, over these next weeks, look at Master Su Yin's instructions on Zen training. But it's interesting that his first thing is... one needs to have a deep trust in the law of cause and effect. So please, you know, it's easy to say, yes, I do, you know, but look deeply into this issue, you know. What are the causes that I've made in my life through my actions of body, speech, and mind, right, that are still very strong within me? And what are the effects of various, you know, family and society, and, you know, how have they affected me that I am who I am today? Buddhism is really about conscious living. It's that ability, I can step back and I can see this ripening within myself, and I can begin to what? To make conscious choices. In the past, I couldn't. I was just driven by my conditioning. But understanding cause and effect, I can see how change is very possible for me. And actually in Buddhism, as you know, the fundamental teaching is each of us have the capacity of becoming Buddhas. Right? Each of us have that enlightened capacity inherently within us. We just have to begin to what? Start making causes for it to come to fruition. So why don't we stop now and have some tea? Thank you all for coming. Just one thing, next not this Sunday, but the following Sunday. There's a day of mindfulness at the Lotus Pond. I think we've asked people to register, and there are already 50 people registered. So we've had to close registration. Is there a way to people go on the waiting list or anything if you haven't registered? So again, if you haven't registered, want to come, just let Angie know. And because oftentimes when you get close, there are people who cancel for one reason or the other.